actually have an intervention that's very similar to what you guys are focused on. It's a nice grouping. I just wanted to say I have nothing to disclose and to thank, I've gotten support from these various foundations. I also want to just thank the team that helped me develop this, including Lisa, who's here in the back, and I'll call her to speak if I get stuck. Okay, so this is a little different, though the intervention is going to be similar sounding to what you just heard. My focus is specifically on individuals who are suffering from a severe persistent mental illness, who are chronically homeless or at risk for incarceration, and who are currently substance using. So sort of the hardcore on the street that we've typically had a lot of trouble engaging. And specifically what I wanted to focus on is one of the areas we've had increasing difficulty in is figuring out how to build social supports and linking that eventually to social integration. So to date, we've actually found a lot of evidence-based practices, which we're going to get to in a second, that deal with housing, shifting the locus of care from hospitals to the community, and basically helping people receive the psychiatric maintenance. But we've had very little success to date with building social supports or social integration. And it's an ongoing problem. So as you can see, some of the this is just a selected literature review, but we know that this is an ongoing difficulty, and that being on the street and being homeless in addition adds to that social distress. Particularly, we get these smaller networks, and there's a lot of research on what these smaller networks lead to, and as you can see, greater illness chronicity, the severity, increased negative symptoms, which is something we'll also talk about in a second, poor social functioning, poor outcomes, and these networks tend to be composed mostly of other people who have psychiatric disorders, and if anyone's familiar with Pesca-Salido's model, what that ultimately means is your network's continuously getting smaller and smaller and smaller with more sick people. So you're generally putting yourself in a situation where you're surrounded by people who need as much help, if not more than you, and that tends to be, from other work we know, notably Karen Lincoln's work, we know that those negative social supports actually have a far worse impact than a positive support would have on your life. So we're really looking at this aspect that's generally unaddressed, that's really impacting in a very harmful way. So to date, there have been some attempts to build social support, and I'm gonna take a second to discuss. There's two types of support we want to think about. One is the formal support, which is us as mental health professionals or health professionals. And that's been pretty easy to build, right? We can get clients to come talk to us. Generally, we hold their money, their medications, and lots of other things. But even if we didn't have that, we're just so charming that they'd want to come talk to us. And we're really good at building that support. But every time we've tried to build this informal support, at least to date, we've seen that that's been a difficult thing. And informal support, generally, we're referring to peers. So a lot of times we promote peers within programs, but we do very little to find out how that peer is viewed by other peers, how that peer is integrating with those other peers, and how that whole network is moving forward. So again, we've basically demonstrated that we can build this formal support. One other note, Kim Muser and colleagues did a meta-analysis in the 90s looking at evidence-based practice and found that we really, again, have not really addressed any of these social aspects for individuals with severe mental illness. And they recently did another one saying that there's possible aspects of this that we're just not capturing. So I just want to point that out as one possibility, that within these evidence-based practices that we're going to discuss in a second, that we may be picking up some of this and we're just not measuring it. And part of that is we're just not thinking about this as an important area. So that's one thing, if you leave today to think about in your work with individuals with severe mental illness, that these are things we should maybe begin to look at and measure. So just a brief, quick overview of the most relevant evidence-based practices for this population. And I just use the abbreviations, but so EBP's evidence-based practice. Assertive community treatment's probably considered the gold standard for community care. And that's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week multidisciplinary treatment team. CTI is critical time intervention. Dan Herman and others have begun to demonstrate that as there's a lot of intense services at the beginning that tailor off once someone is stable. Interesting, that's the only one to date that's actually shown an impact on negative symptoms, and I told you we'll get to that in a second. Supported employment is kind of self-explanatory, same with supported housing and housing first. I didn't put you guys separately, but I should have. And then psychoeducation, which I'm going to talk about more. So we're left with these gaps in care with these evidence-based practices, which is the social isolation I mentioned, building that social support. Another one is that self-awareness for consumers. So, and you know, I'm just going to switch with every nomenclature: consumers, clients, whatever strikes you. That's the one I mean to say. Awareness or insight. So that's another thing that throughout time we've demonstrated we haven't really been able to impact, is that insight into one's own mental illness. And then these daily living activities and life satisfaction. So these are all areas that remain, even though the evidence base has moved forward greatly in the last 20 years. And again, individuals with severe and persistent mental illness have this harder time building supports. And now I want to finally address that negative symptoms. Part of this is a few things. So as a social workers, and I don't know how many of us are in the room, but we really focus on this life course, those opportunities you have or lose throughout dealing with this chronic and severe mental illness. Another one is the constant transition. So one of the things about that formal and informal support is, and I think the gentleman was talking about the emergency room, you know, so thinking about how many people are going to how many emergency rooms and how many people they're interacting with. There's just these constant transitions, and that's within the formal network. So you can imagine in the informal network what's going on in one's life. And then there's the impact of negative symptoms, which we generally don't address. And to date, as I said, there's been very little in literature, both in psychopharmacology and in psychotherapy. Negative symptoms are the absence of symptoms. So positive symptoms we're more familiar with. Those are hearing, hearing voices, things like that. So additional symptoms that you generally would not think someone should have. Negative symptoms are a lack of enjoyment, atahenia. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It always gets me. But generally, trouble connecting with others, having a flat affect, feeling withdrawn, feeling that it's hard to talk. And that's an area that, if you think about it for a second, is probably one of the big drivers for some of the behaviors that we think of as harmful, right? Because people are shutting themselves off. They are becoming more isolated. Part of that is, you know, their own mental illness kind of propelling them to do that. So we need to also think about addressing those negative symptoms. So again, just thinking about that, I mentioned before the network episode model, and this is sort of just a similar thing. One thing that I should have added in that I don't have is stigma, because if you put stigma in there, that's going to further the cycle. And so you just think of this as a spiral getting ever, ever smaller. But basically, these negative symptoms are going to cause people to withdraw. Being withdrawn is then going to cause them to feel that no one, you know, cares for them, and they don't care for anyone else, which is going to lead to this low level of self-satisfaction, low self-esteem, and it's going to continue, and people are going to become very withdrawn. So that's the background. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to think of an intervention that could build support. Particularly, we were looking to decrease that loneliness and isolation, to improve those community living skills, to improve that level of social support, and to increase that self-awareness and self-care activities. Just some of the theoretical background for what we're drawing on, stress and coping models, the positive human health model, and network episode model. I'm not going to go through all of these just for time, but basically we thought about, you know, what theoretical benefits might a model need to incorporate to move forward. So the model we came up with is called the Community Awareness Psychoeducation. And so today I'm going to focus on the immediate outcomes or primary outcomes, because those are the outcomes that we tried to measure in this study. And then I'm going to talk of where we are now, because I'm presenting data that's a little older. This was done during my dissertation, and then now we've just finished, Lisa and I finished replicating it in Los Angeles. So this study was done in New York City at two sites, and we'll get to that in a second. But just so the idea here is, if we could address these primary outcomes, that would then lead to these increased recovery activities, and then the long-term outcomes, which would be that integrated, socially well person. Again, we also have a 12-session psychoeducation model, and I was very fortunate to to work with Ellen Lukens, who was one of the people who worked on the original psychoeducation efficacy studies. So she gave me a lot of great ideas. We changed it a little bit because originally psychoeducation as an evidence-based practice is focused for inpatient settings or for multiple family settings, but still somewhat inpatient. So it's always been kind of tethered to teaching people about how to manage their illness, how to manage their medication. We wanted to obviously change that because we're talking about the population that's not engaged in treatment, that's kind of on the street and needed to first understand their illness and understand how that might help them dealing with that, how that might help them connect and become more integrated into the community. So these are some of the topics that we focused on. So and then our hypothesis were, you know, we would have these impacts, again, to decrease the loneliness, improve the community living, the social support, self-awareness. And then one other thing that we were interested about, because this is the era of evidence-based practice, and we know ACT has certain limitations with social social integration, could we improve ACT? Could these evidence-based practices, can we begin to start thinking about how we might make them better, the next generation? So the study design was, we used some focus groups with some staff and with some clients to first figure out, you know, are we on the right track? Is there any face validity to what we're thinking about? And they seemed to think there was. So then we wanted to move to a pilot study. So what we wanted to do, and this is David's suggestion, we used a waitlist comparison group. So again, these are people who were primarily, and I'll show you the demographics in a second, primarily on the street. So what we want to do is recruit them, and then some would be waitlisted for treatment in the future, and they would then be compared to the people who got treatment right away. And the two sites we used were in Upper Manhattan, so the Goddard Riverside ACT team and the New York State Psychiatric Institute Inwood Outpatient Clinic. And at pre and post, we want to collect some demographics and standardized scales. And what I'm going to primarily talk about are three of those scales. We didn't collect a lot of scales because, again, it was a dissertation, and I wanted to finish sometime in the decade, which I did. So I guess good strategy. But primarily, these were the areas we wanted to focus on: the community living skills, the loneliness, which measures that loneliness and isolation, and recovery assessment. We also looked at some demographics on housing, substance use, things like that. We also included some ethnographic observations, some process recordings, which we had MSW interns do and then analyze for content, and then some open-ended questions at post-test. And what we did is everyone got a pre-test baseline. Some people were then sent to waitlist comparison, some people got active treatment. Then about 3 months, which, you know, 12 sessions took about 3 months, they would get a post-test. At that point, we would do a second pre-test for that waitlist comparison. They'd begin treatment, and then they would get a post-test. And this is kind of continuous, so even though it's nice and neat here, you know, it's real-world research, and this is nicer to look at. Okay, so this is what we ended up with, 45 participants. And I put West Side and Upper Manhattan for where we recruited. And as you can see, we got about a total of 24 in treatment and 21 in comparison. Of that 21, so the 24, it's a little misleading. Of the 24, 13 of those were people who were waitlisted. So we were then counting them in treatment. And then we decided to drop them from the comparison. So what we're gonna end up with is a comparison of 24 to 10, if that makes sense, okay. So this is the mean age of the treatment versus comparison. There wasn't any, you know, difference here. Male, we had you know, sort of roughly the same. Comparison was a little bit more female than male, and that just happened again. You know, this was meant to be a very applicable real world community test, and so because it's a group intervention, the way we had to group people, sometimes we had more men available to group right away, and more women were sent to comparison. So, you know, just one difference there. This is the breakdown of ethnicity. And again, it was primarily people of color. African American were the largest group, and then also Hispanic, primarily people of descent from the Dominican Republic. Okay, so primarily most people had schizophrenia, were diagnosed with schizophrenia. and other psychotic disorders. In the comparison group, and this is part of that gender difference, right? Women generally are diagnosed with schizophrenia much less than men for various reasons, so they tend to show up more as bipolar or schizoaffective or borderline personalities. And the housing status, interestingly, at treatment, we had more people who were in an apartment at the time, and was a little different for the comparison group. So relationship status, most people were single. There was a few who were married and divorced, and we were curious about relationships. We asked a bunch of questions about relationships because, again, this is about social integration, social support. Whoa, okay, 5 minutes? I'll hurry. All right, as you can see, it was a pretty severely ill population. Over half had been hospitalized within the last year, almost half or over half had been incarcerated within the last year, and also over half had been homeless within the last year. So, again, a lot of transition. We'll skip through some of these. Okay, so the findings. Basically using a t-test that comparing the baseline to the post-test, we did find that for the treatment group we had a significant improvement in and the main thing we were looking at, that loneliness, we had a very significant improvement there. We also, for this living skills scale, one thing we figured out was that was completely the wrong scale to use. So we were curious about living skills, and in my head I had conceptualized that meaning, could people function in the community? This scale was more, do people do laundry, do people do showers? But when you're homeless, you know, it's not quite on the top of your list, I'm going to do my laundry and shower today. You know, we have to refine the measurement a little bit. And then the self-awareness scale, we didn't find a significant improvement on the scale, but on some of the subscales, we did find, we found a good trend. Actually, if this was a one-tailed test, it would be significant and it would be in the right direction. So, you know, I could get away with saying it was significant in the right direction, but I'll just be honest and do the two-tailed thing here. But we did find some goal and success orientation, positive reliance on others, again, building those peer networks that we hope for. And then the other big one was the success with treatment goals, which if we take with that goal and success orientation, we kind of figure is really a measure of treatment engagement, so that we were actually really able to improve this long-term chronically ill population that generally did not engage in treatment. We were actually get them to engage in treatment. Okay, I better hurry. We had some qualitative data, which you know, people felt great. Staff observations, the staff were very surprised. So just to give you a picture of the population, you know, if you walk into many of these mental health act teams or clinics, you'll see a waiting room of people waiting for their meds and money, none of them talking to each other. They come day after day, none of them know each other's names. So at the end, we had at one site, the clients asked for a bench. They got a bench. They were sitting outside. They were beginning to talk and engage. So the staff were floored by that because they kind of thought, you know, these guys never talk. You're not going to get anything out of them. So it was very, very encouraging. These are kind of the limitations that it was a pilot study, so it's a little limited sample size, wasn't randomized. There were some site differences, and we didn't have non-English. So practice implications, you know, I'm going to skip the implications and just basically the implications you could kind of figure out for the practice and policy. But I just wanted to say where we were now because I think it's interesting. So taking that information, Lisa has worked with me, and we refined it a little bit, and we've added a little bit of a mindfulness-based component. And we've recently, and that was because, again, we didn't see that significant improvement in that awareness, which we were hoping for, although we saw some of those other gains that we saw. And we recently concluded another pilot study, this time in Los Angeles, because I moved, at two sites, one county-run and one private county-contracted clinic. So we finished two groups there, and I've got the data, begun analysis, and so we hope to continue to build this model and move it forward. So any questions or comments? Yes.
Back and talk a little bit about recruitment, and I mean, since you worked so directly on it, I think you probably have thought through this enough.
Yes.
But some of the thoughts about how you selected from the two different sites, and then any kind of selection bias coming from the...
Okay. So, in terms of recruitment, what we did is, you know, the IRB procedure, we posted flyers, we went to community meetings, and we announced, and anyone who was interested was supposed to come see us. You know, we offered an incentive, so as you can imagine, almost everybody came to see us. The problem was more how many groups could I physically run and how could I also finish a dissertation, and I had two small kids at the time and managed those two kids. So that was kind of the limiting criteria. Otherwise, we would have probably recruited almost everyone because we offered a cash incentive and food. We just selected who was ready to go, whoever was ready at that time to start a group. So some people would be interested, and they would say, not right now, I'm looking for, you know, something, or want to, you know. But we wanted to be as community real as possible. So not to say you have to first go through months of treatment, months of rehab, and then you'll be ready for our group. You know, so that was sort of the...
I'm sorry to rush.
Okay.
If you could maybe save the email and talk after, to be fair to the last group, I really...
Okay, and I'll hang out here. And they have a video.
They said, no intro. They said, we need to go. Let's go.